Good morning.
Good morning.
So this morning, I want to talk about five hindrances or difficulties that come up in Buddhist practice and that are talked about in the scriptures, and that I've talked about before, but I don't know, years ago, and I couldn't find my notes. So, but those of you who've been around Buddhism have heard these discussed on different occasions. So the five hindrances, essentially weaknesses or difficulties that we encounter, and that make it hard for us to wake up in the Zen sense, to wake up to just being present, just being here in calmness. And they are doubt, sloth or sleepiness, restlessness, anger, and desire, in no particular order. Today, that's the particular order, but generally no particular order. So doubt. So I'm going to talk about each of them for maybe, I don't know, 5 minutes, and then talk about dealing with them. So doubt, starting with doubt. I would like to suggest there are two types of doubt, but I'm sure there are infinite types. But these two, the first type of doubt is the doubt about our lives. What should we be doing? Should we be sitting here or should we be at home? Should we be with this partner or should we be with that partner? Should we be with this job or should we be with that job? Am I in the right relationship? Am I with the right partner? Am I with the right teacher? And doubt. And that's a human condition. That's, we say freedom of choice in America, but some people would say that's the curse of choice for us as Americans. It's a wonderful freedom, but also we make it into a curse, don't we? We make it into a curse. And the second kind of doubt is a doubt that comes, I think, when we've been practicing for some time. And it can come in other contexts, I suppose, but particularly when we've been practicing for some time. When we've been practicing for some time and when our nice solid world starts to fall away, when we begin to see the lack of solidity in our world and in our storylines, that they can't support us, that the world that we carry around in here isn't working. We're beginning to drop those away in our meditation, which is cool. But it's also then, at some point, as Hakuin especially talks about, Hakuin, you really begin to doubt, because this isn't especially pleasant, this letting go of this stuff, this seeing this, the fragility and the impermanence of everything. Isn't so you begin to doubt. In practice period, we're studying the gateless gate or the gateless barrier. And Robert Aiken talks about the dark night of the soul. And he talks about it in that way, that it comes from spiritual practice, comes from spiritual immersion. And on Wednesday night, I talked about the interchange between the student and the teacher. And the student has been practicing for a long time, and he comes to the teacher and he says, I'm alone and destitute. Help me. I'm alone and destitute. Help me. So he's beginning through his practice. I mean, we don't know if he's been practicing for a year or 10 years, but he's beginning to see that he can't count on anything. That he can't even count on his best friend, because his best friend may die or may become somebody else's best friend. So please help me, teacher. And Aiken Roshi says, That's great. Good for him. Meaning encouraging that doubt. Good for him. And then being open about it. Coming to his teacher and being open. Being vulnerable. So that's doubt. And the second one is restlessness. Restlessness. Another some would say uniquely American phenomena, but I don't think that's the case. I don't think that's the case. I think we're too hard on ourselves. but it is very, very prevalent. Very prevalent. My son is always encouraging me to get more TV channels. And just 6 months ago, I got my first cable. I got mini cable. But he said, Dad, that's not enough. But already, I see myself playing that game in front of the TV. So apparently, men do more than women. Some research. Talk about restless. And here, our culture is encouraging that. It's promoting that. So that's why we really need this kind of practice in our culture. We really need to just settle into being present with our breathing, with each other, with whatever, even with our zazen. So when I was a child, I used to go to Mexico, on the west coast of Mexico, with my family. And as a kid, we would go to the coast and we would do lots of things on the beach. We snorkeled, we swam, we body surfed, and the females in our family would lie and try to get their tans just right. Not that the males were interested in that, but they were more interested in the other stuff. And what would the Mexicans do when they would come out to the beach? Stand in the water. They didn't swim. They didn't snorkel. They didn't try to get tan. In these towns we used to go to years ago, they would just stand in the water. They would stand sometimes for a half an hour, sometimes for an hour, sometimes for a couple hours. And I said to my sister, what are they doing? I mean, it was, you know, something like 11 or 12, and she said, they're standing, Tim. And I thought, how boring. How boring. But that's what we need to, we need to return that value into our lives as human beings, so that it's not boring. That if we really do it, it doesn't matter whether it's on a cushion or it's in the water or it's by the lake, it fills us up. It brings us back to our original stillness. So I talked in a couple of talks ago about last summer I hurt my back and I wasn't able to be here every morning. So instead I had to be home lying on my back. And I was restless. And I had to say to myself, Tim, here's a chance to just be with your, be lying on your back. Your pain's not very bad. Just breathe in and just breathe out. And I was able to do it. But you would think, wouldn't you, that I'm a meditation expert, right? But there I was. There I was. So don't ever think you're an expert at anything. If you think you're an expert at anything, you'll be restless and you'll want to move on to something else. Someone asked Nijinsky about his dancing, how he could dance in such a marvelous way. And he said that there had to be some stillness in it. There had to be some stillness in it. He said, it's really quite simple. I merely leap and pause. Leap and pause. So this is about learning how to do that. It's a very simple practice that we do. But don't forget the pause. If you really do the pause, the leap just is quite balanced. If you don't do the pause, the leap loses its life, loses its connection. So the third one, sleepiness and sloth and torpor and all those things. Sleepiness, sloth, torpor. The habit of going unconscious. Going unconscious. And I think there are different reasons it comes. One, we're tired. We are tired. We are tired. Did you know this bit of trivia? That before electricity in the United States, the average American, I don't know where they got this data. I don't see how they could have even done a survey, but this is what they said. The average American got between 9 and 10 hours sleep a night. Now the average American gets between 6 and 7. So we're getting 3 hours less sleep a night in the average. So no wonder we're tired. No wonder we're tired. So that's the first kind of sleepiness or sloth or torpor. No wonder we're burned out. If we're not tired, if we don't go to sleep, then we just veg in front of the TV for 3.5 hours or do something in which we're mostly unconscious. So the next kind is sleepiness or sloth or torpor in meditation. In meditation, of all places. How could it be coming up in meditation? Well, that's interesting. Maybe it's because you're tired. It's possible that you've only been getting 5 3/4 hours sleep a night. Well, then, duh. Duh. Or it could be that you're just so unaccustomed to stillness. Your psyche, your body is so unaccustomed to stillness that when you're completely still and everybody else completely still, that there's a cue. Oh, it must be bedtime. Oh, your body is saying, its body is not used to stillness, saying it's night-night time. This happens a lot, especially in retreats, but also in daily sitting. And then torpor, sloth, sleepiness, due to resistance, right? Due to resistance. I can remember in college, I tried to sleep through as many classes as I could, and I was pretty good at it. Pretty good at it. But I was avoiding, I was resisting anxiety, conflict. So lots of ways we resist by blottoing ourselves out, either with drugs and alcohol or sleep or torpor, TV, whatever, because our pain is too hard for us to feel. We don't want to feel the pain, whatever it is, whatever it is. Anger. Fourth one. Anger. Anger is painful in the body if you pay attention to it. It creates tension, different places of the body. There's heat, there's burning. Anger makes us feel alive. Makes us feel real. Especially if it's righteous anger. He did that to her. And he shouldn't have. And it wakes me up. How dare he? How dare she? It gives us a sense of being alive, being real. (Clears throat) Jack Kornfield talks about going to his teacher in India and telling him how angry he was about someone in the Sangha had behaved. Do you ever get any angry about it, the way someone in the Sangha behaves? Well, maybe not if you're not part of the Sangha yet. Maybe you don't want to join the Sangha because that might happen to you. Whatever your Sangha is, if it's your family, if it's your job, if it's here, it's all the same. So he went to go see his teacher. It was in the hot season in India, he says, and he was wearing those little flip-flop sandals. He got up and went over to the table where we were sitting, and he kicked the table leg. It looked like it hurt him. Then he held his foot and he hopped around for a while. Then he sat back down and kind of massaged his foot. Then he looked at me and he shook his head. That's all he did. Acting it out. Showing Jack what he was doing. You can only say bear attention so many times. Sometimes you have to demonstrate it. So, with anger, what we usually do is put fuel on the fire. The initial blast of anger passes through us, but then we either magnify it or generalize it through our stories, through what we say to ourselves. And I've actually talked about this, and John Wellwood has talked about this, and Jack Kornfield, lots of people. But it's easy to talk about it, but to practice it, to really be aware of it, to really see when we're doing it, that's what this is about. So on Sundays, I'll give you an example. This is a made-up example. On Sundays, I see people in Doksan, one-to-one upstairs, people who want help on their meditation or something related to their practice, and they sign up. I'm always happy to see people. So let's pretend that it's my last Doksan, and my wife is waiting for me. Maybe some for it to go to a play or something. The person who signed up is not there. Well, I'm probably going to get angry, right? And then am I going to magnify the anger? I have a choice. I see the anger. It comes up fast. Anger comes up fast, right? Really fast. But I have a choice. I have a choice to magnify it by remembering something else that person did and then putting that piece of wood on the fire and then remembering something else they did and something else they did and something else they did and then what they might do next time if I possibly agree to see them again. And that's magnifying, right? Magnifying. And the other thing we do with anger is we generalize. So during coffee hour, which is coming up not so long from now, maybe you turn your attention to someone to say hi, and they turn away from you, and you feel hurt. You feel hurt, and you feel pissed because you have a relationship with that person, and they just turned away and talked to someone else. You feel pissed. So then you generalize. You could magnify too, but right, these little categories are just categories. Don't really believe them. Then you can generalize. Oh, you leave the coffee hour and you say, oh, people are not friendly there. After I talked with her, I had a pretty good conversation with him, but then you don't even remember it. You remember other times here that people were not friendly to you. And you say, oh, this is not a friendly community. I remember these people are cold. They don't reach out to each other. And That's how, and then you feel that way about your family when you go home because you're really generalizing. I don't want to be around people. People are just not nice. And the more fuel you put on the fire, the more the anger becomes solid and real. And it gives you an identity, right? But it's not a very happy identity. It's not a very bodhisattva. I mean, most of us would want to be bodhisattvas, so there's not much bodhisattva potential in that identity. So what we need to try to practice, what I've been trying to practice since I began doing this, is the middle way around anger. The middle way. Not indulging, not repressing. And when I'm expressing anger towards someone, grounding it, if I can, in my immediate sense experience. I heard this, I saw this, I felt this. And rather than rushing to an interpretation, and then another interpretation, and then another interpretation, I'm leaving out my immediate sense experience, my immediate feeling, and just getting caught by consciousness. The fifth aggregate, getting carried away by the fifth aggregate and forgetting about sensation, perception. And then when I share with the person, I can share that this is, it's just an interpretation. That's all it is. But it led me to this feeling of anger. And it was because I saw you turn your head away from me when I was trying to say something very important to you. Something life, potentially life-saving to you. But then that's my interpretation, isn't it? That's my interpretation. So then there is the issue about, what about righteous anger? I mean, didn't Jesus throw the money lenders out of the temple? Wasn't that cool? I mean, lots of us are social activists. Partly it comes from anger. Yes, I think that's the middle way. Sure. But we even need to be careful of that, because what's the line between righteous anger, which really comes out of bodhisattva affection and caring for all life, and self-righteous anger? Where's the line? I have to walk this line every day in my other job, because I come from a family that was destroyed by mental illness, destroyed, wiped out by mental illness and its stigma. And in my job, I'm always with that, because that's my job. My job is to develop and support services to people with mental illness. And so the anger that I still feel motivates me to do good things. But then at some point, it can be self-righteous. At some point, I can start saying, "Plenty." Or someone, and then I just have to take a deep breath, come back to being here. And the last one is desire. Maybe the most generic one. And of course, what Buddhism, the ground of Buddhism, not getting what we want and getting what we don't want, and trying to get what we want and trying to keep away from what we don't want. Basic Buddhism 101, if there is such a thing. Oscar Wilde said, "I can resist anything but temptation." He and Buddha would have gotten along, don't you think? I can resist anything but temptation. And that's such a big one. I don't really want to talk in generalities about that one, but I want to give a talk a little about specific desires. There's the kind of desires that come up in meditation. especially in long meditations, which could be called the Shikantaza romance, or the Vipassana romance, if you're doing that, or the Zazen romance. Because when you're sitting for long times facing the wall, you have a lot of time to let a desire come in and then turn it into romance. And it's kind of disquieting if you're not used to it. But you should never get too used to it. Because if you get too used to it, it will just get... You'll just be sitting here romancing the whole time. And what I mean is, for example... Do you know what I mean? I don't know. What I mean, for example, is an example. Okay, we're sitting here in meditation. It's during retreat. And I smell spinach cooking in the kitchen. And I love spinach. And I think, oh, maybe spinach pie for lunch. And I'm beginning to get into the Shikantaza romance. Oh, Linda used to cook spinach pie. I wonder when she's going to cook spinach pie again. It would be nice if she cooked one. We could have some people over, have all of our friends over and cook spinach pie. And then have wine. But Linda doesn't drink wine. Well, some of us could have wine. And then, who would I invite? Well, I might invite you, but not you. And, you. Yes, after Sesshin, I'll call you guys up. You'll come to my house and have spinach pie. And we'll drink wine, and we'll do it a night of the football Ding. Game. The Shikantaza romance. Yeah, right? Or the Zazen romance, or the Vipassana romance. So, Shikantaza is it means just to sit. Shikantaza, just to sit. And that's what Dogen talks about, just to sit. But the way I teach Zen here is to kind of beware of Shikantaza. Because it's so easy to get into Shikantaza romance. To really focus other ways first before you do Shikantaza. Unless you're really good at it. Because you'll spend your whole time romancing. And that's not what Dogen had in mind, I don't think. I'm not absolutely sure. Because Dogen is quite malleable in the way he presents himself. And he does talk about eating the painting of the rice cake, so... And then we have the if-only desires. Oh, if only. If only. If only I didn't have a busy mind. If only I could be like Tim. Or if only I could be like whomever. How did I get saddled with this busy mind? If only. If only I were 6'6" instead of 5'6". How did I end up being 6'6"? 5'6", excuse me. I love to play basketball. I can't ever play basketball with anybody. They just shove the basketball down my throat. If only I had been 6'6 instead of 5'6". If only my parents hadn't had depression. Then I wouldn't be such a basket case. If only they had a few parenting skills. Just one or two parenting skills. Then I'd have a life. If only. If only. If only I hadn't started doing Zazen when I was 59 years old. If only I'd started it when I was 16. If only. If only I'd never tried to do Zazen and wasted all this time sitting facing this stupid wall doing these Shikantaza romances. If only. If only. Right? Very interesting. Very interesting. So the very process of wanting is painful. It's painful because we don't feel complete, and we're reaching out to get something we don't have instead of just being with what is, even with the pain. And then we strive not to feel the desire by losing ourselves in something, by drinking or drugs or TV or whatever we lose ourselves in. Or ignoring, trying to ignore the stuff. And then it comes up in some twisted way. It comes up in some twisted way. So, how do we do it? Work with this? Well, we work with this in the way that our teachers work with it and the way that it's been worked with for a long, long time. Our goal is to avoid covering up our difficulties, all these different difficulties that come up. Avoid covering them up. Because the difficulties, this is one of my mantras, the difficulties are the entryways. Those are the entryways. So we need to avoid that. And we need to begin to pay attention to them. Begin to pay attention to the stories and how we're hypnotized by them. And have faith that we can do it. That it's okay if you started at 59 years old. It's okay if you have a busy mind. It's okay if your parents were horse shit. Poor parents. I wonder what my kids are saying about me. It's okay. You can open to this nature. It's the Buddha nature, right? Everybody has it. You can do it. You have to have some faith in it. Really, you have to have faith. And when you lose it, you have to reawaken it somehow. There's reawaken it. There are lots of different ways to reawaken it. Rilke talks about faith. Rilke says, I have faith. Let me read the whole thing. Rilke says, you darkness that I come from, out of which all things come, I love you more than all the fires that fence in the world, for the fire makes a circle of light for everyone, and then no one outside learns of you. But the darkness pulls in everything, shapes and fires, animals and myself. How easily it gathers them, powers and people. It is possible a great energy is moving near us. I have faith in night. So that's Rilke. So with a little bit of faith, enough faith to just do this practice, Then we do it. Then we notice our patterns. We notice our patterns. We pay bare attention, bare awareness to our patterns. Do we have more of a tendency to get angry, or more of a tendency to veg out, or more of a tendency to be restless, or more of a tendency to be doubtful and confused? And what are the, Jack Kornfield used to say, I don't know if he still says it, but what are the top 10 tunes, he used to say. What are the top 10 tunes? What are the popular patterns? It's good to learn. It's good to learn. It's helpful in this practice. Because usually your popular patterns are the same ones that have been with you for a long time. Whether you've been doing Zen practice or not Zen practice for a long, long, long time. And it's good to know them. It's good to bring them into awareness. So that then specifically, when you say to yourself, for instance, oh, this isn't going right. This partner of mine is no good. I should look for another partner. Then at least you're reflecting on what's going on here. Is this doubt? Is this restlessness? Or is there something more? There's something more. Thank you. And if there's something more, then it should be looked into. So we need to make friends with anger, with sloth, with all of these. Make friends with them and receive them in our hearts, completely in our hearts, and observe how they change. They change. They all change. They all change. Try to notice their antecedents. Try to notice how they fade away. And work with them as our practice. Anger especially is so strong that sometimes it's almost impossible to work with. Almost impossible. But not entirely impossible. And you can start by working with mild irritation. Really, mild irritation. We get swept away by big anger. And so even if we've been doing Zazen for 33 years, we still get swept away. But we can... mild irritation. And big anger, which we can catch at least before we do harm, generally. And then also, notice that usually there's underlying fear. Usually there is. Usually that's what supports these different emotions. Underlying fear. Some basic fundamental fear about life, about being. And that's why we need the anger. That's why we need the sloth, because we don't want to break through the ice. We're skating on the ice. On the ice of the anger, the ice of the doubt. We don't want to break through. The fear is kind of scary. But this, it's okay. It's okay. It won't kill you. It won't kill you. And if we keep doing this, if we keep this practice of a regular meditation practice and then extending that awareness into our daily life as much as we can without being too critical or too self-conscious about it, we can settle into just being. We can settle into what's called Buddha nature. What's called Buddha nature. Which is our birthright. It's our birthright. And it's available. It's always available. And that's why we do things like have practice periods. We're having a practice period now at Zen Center. And our practice periods are 7 weeks long, twice a year. And somebody said to me, that's not the traditional way. It's not the traditional way. The traditional way is to do them for 100 days rather than 50 days or 55 days. But the traditional way is based on what? It's based on the monsoon season in India. If we do everything according to the monsoon season in India, or according to the way the Japanese related to each other in samurai medieval Japan, I don't know, you guys. I don't know. Do we want to do that kind of tradition? I mean, really. So they did 100 days, and that's cool, but I'm just delighted when this time 25 people signed up to do it for 50 days. Wow. 25 people made a commitment to sit every day, to come on Wednesday night or Tuesday morning and look at koans. A koan is a difficulty, right? Anger is a koan. Sloth is a koan. Look at koans. Look at difficulties. And to come here on the weekends. And people have a hard time making it for 50 days. But some people do. That's cool because we have very busy lives. This is not the monsoon season in India and 200 before the contemporary era. So I want to close with a poem from Emily Dickinson. Emily Dickinson. When much in the woods as a little girl, I was told that the snake would bite me, that I might pick a poisonous flower or mushroom, or the goblins would kidnap me. But I went along and met none but angels. So I think that's what I want to say for this morning, and I'd be glad to entertain questions or comments.
Yeah. Can you give an example of how you break through the ice to the fear?
No, not. I don't mean to be flip. No, I can't. You do it by paying attention to it. You do it by paying attention to whatever it is. If it's your restlessness, then you pay attention to your restlessness. You notice what your restlessness is saying, why it is you feel that you need to do all these things. What are you telling yourself? And you watch it. You're with it, and you come back to your body and you breathe. And then at some point, it breaks up. It breaks up. And when it does break up, it's initially quite scary often. Well, sometimes it's liberating, but often quite scary. Is that helpful? Okay. Bill.
You started out talking about doubt.
About what?
Doubt is one of the hindrances.
I can't hear you.
Doubt.
Huh?
Doubt.
Yeah, doubt. D-O-U-B-T. Yep.
And could you relate that to Hawking's great doubt?
I did. I related it to, I said there were, I was talking this morning about two types of doubt. The initial doubt when we just, I'm initial, but I don't mean initial like at the beginning of our lives. I mean any time. You know, I was with my friend last night who said, you know, he's 59. He said, geez, I'm thinking I should be, I don't like this career. And maybe I should be doing something other career. But this career versus that career, and I'm just crazy. That kind of doubt is the first doubt. It's just the doubt of trying to figure out what we want because our heart isn't connected with our head. In that doubt, our heart is not connected with our head. So that we don't really know what our core, I didn't talk about this earlier, but we don't know really what our core values are. And I don't mean kind of intellectual values, but our core kind of values in here. And that doubt is caused because the two aren't connected. That's the first kind of doubt. Second kind of doubt is Hawking's doubt. It's the doubt that comes from through difficult practice. When we begin, and Hawking is an example of someone who, I mean, he's kind of a dramatic example of someone who, through his difficult practice, through looking and seeing all the facades he created, all the ways his story kept developing new iterations, let go of those, but didn't feel any better. Felt more isolated, more alone, more confused. And his teacher said, you know, good. Good. Although, you know, there's dramatic stories about that. Until he broke through. So that's what Rinzai people call the great doubt, and it's based on Hawking. Does that make sense? And that can happen in Soto Zen too, but when we start labeling these things too much, then we start expecting it. And, you know, it might not happen that way. It might not happen that way. Anything else this morning, guys?
Is that where you would put Luther's "Here I stand, I can do no other"?
Luther, you know, I don't know Luther well enough. Somebody asked me about Kierkegaard last week. I know Kierkegaard a little bit. I don't know Luther at all. What do you know, Luther?
That's about. I mean, I know the stories of him, of, you know, his asceticism and that, and finally coming to a point where this is it. I can't do anything else.
I see. And, well,
And I find, you know, in my studies and in my spiritual travels, I found a great power in that, too. Because it all falls away, and there is nothing else. It is just this. And I think that's why I have such a love for Zen, is that it is just this. There is no other. And even if I, it's like I'm reading Every Moment of the Universe, Ken Gurry, and he talks about the decorations that we keep hanging on stuff, and they're okay, but you just got to remember it's just decorations. But and that's why I think about it, is that great doubt that leaves us with, what am I? You're just, you know, it's just this. It's not anything more than that. I don't know if I'm hitting Luther or not.
Okay.
That was the first time I heard that statement by him, interpreted that way. You can say, here I stand, and I can do no other. I always thought, well, the other way of approaching it was, he made a very difficult decision, which was to confront the problems in the Catholic Church. And his inner self just would not let him do anything other than face that confrontation publicly. So, I don't know, it's a different...
No, I'm going to have to read it. I never thought I'd be interested in reading about Luther, but see, that's my prejudice. My prejudice, huh?
Right. He's the adversary of Superman.
Anything else? Yeah.
I like that metaphor about the top 10 popular.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The thing I've noticed is the one that's climbing the charts is the Zen voice.
The Zen voice?
Which I think you just talked about well with Rinzai. If you have these solid ideas about things, expectations.
That's right.
Even though we don't get those from you, we start creating them.
That's right.
And so that's definitely like...
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, the Zen too. No boy. Okay. Thank you.